Well, hello and welcome to Talk About Jazz with Doug Hall. I'm your host, Doug Hall, and our guest today is Veronica Leahy, and she is a current student enrolled in the Harvard and Berkeley dual degree program. She has just graduated, and she is a saxophonist, multi-woodwind player, and pianist. At Berkeley, she is specifically enrolled in the Jazz and Gender Justice Group. So welcome, Veronica. And we're very happy to have you here. We're going to talk a little bit about your background and have you share with us a bit about how you came to music and your instrument and your musical education and career directions. So I thought I would start back to maybe a stage in your life where you discovered that you had a musical interest and a musical ability. So when did that happen in your life?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. So I started playing music. Well, it's hard to remember a time when I wasn't playing music. I think I started playing piano when I was 3 years old. And I'm actually a classically trained pianist. That's my background. Yeah. And but I was always wanting to improvise off of the pieces that I was learning, and my teacher didn't like that very much. But yeah, so I sort of came from the world of classical piano, and I had a real passion for the music. I didn't always love the culture surrounding the music, and my dad's a jazz trumpet player, not professionally, but that's. Mm-hmm. You know, his big passion in life. And so he'd always exposed me to Louis and Ella and, you know, all of the greats. And so I always wanted to play jazz. I always wanted to improvise. And so I started playing saxophone in the fourth grade. And here we are.
Wow. Well, tell me, now you've exposed that you've both been playing the saxophone, but that's your primary instrument, and then piano. Take us forward to how the opportunity developed for you to find your way to Berkeley and the Berkeley program.
Yeah, so I've always found that my musical life was so enriched by my academic and intellectual life. I've always found that there is such a rich connection between the two. And I remember in high school, my eternal struggle was like, do I go to a conservatory or do I go to a traditional university? I knew there was never a question in my mind that I wanted to make music for the rest of my life, but I also found that my studies in history and math and science really informed what I was doing. And it was this like symbiotic relationship that was like, I don't know. I've always felt like using my brain in lots of different ways was really important for me to develop as an artist. And so, I was really torn about this. And then I think it was my junior year of high school, the Harvard Berkeley program was announced. It was very new. And I remember being like, that's the dream. Like, that's exactly what I want. And I really liked Berkeley because it's such an open-minded institution. Mm-hmm. As somebody who plays a lot of different instruments and a lot of different genres of music, I really didn't want to be boxed in, you know, in undergrad. I really wanted the chance to play jazz, but also not play stuff that maybe wasn't labeled as jazz. I don't know, like just improvise, create, compose, whatever sort of my heart desired. And so I really liked that Berkeley sort of doesn't require you to come in as a jazz saxophone major specifically. Mm-hmm. You just audition and you get to do whatever you want there. You can take classes in music production and, you know, conducting and jazz and, you know, so all these things were exciting to me. And so that's why I really like Berkeley. And so the chance to get to do both Berkeley and Harvard at the same time felt like a dream come true.
Right.
And it happened, so, yeah.
Wow. And that split is new to me, the Harvard-Berkeley dual degree program. So in a sense, you have both the Harvard program is going to demand more sort of, in a sense, intellectual studying that will relate some of your interests in that direction, then Berklee is obviously the direct musical vein that you pursue, right?
Yes, and I ended up being a music concentrator and a theater secondary, we call it. It's basically a minor at Harvard, but it was always like more from the composition, musicology, music theory side of things. And at Berklee, it was more about putting all those things into practice.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Now tell me, within the Berklee program, as you are performing with other students, tell me about the relationships that, or you can use an example specifically, that you developed with maybe another student learning from maybe their approach to music or their technique or their philosophy about music?
Oh my gosh, so many folks come to mind.
Okay.
I think like that was the best part of college if I had to choose. It was really just like the peers and I feel like we learned so much from each other and being like, hey, can you play on my project? And yeah, I'll play on your project. And like, you know, a lot of times it's just, let's experiment with something. We're not even getting paid for this. We're just doing this in our, you know, dorm room or whatever. But like those were the learning experiences. Those were the labs, if you will.
I
remember my freshman year. So I had sort of come into college, coming up on the jazz scene in Charlotte, North Carolina. That's where I grew up.
Okay.
And the scene there was a lot of sort of straight ahead jazz, for lack of a better term, but a lot of, you know, carrying the sort of tradition and swing forward. And I love that, bebop and hard bop and like that. Those are my roots. And then a peer of mine who was in the Harvard NEC dual degree program, Miranda Agnew, is a wonderful trumpet player. I remember she was a few years older than me, and she asked me to play in her band. And she was doing, you know, something totally different than what I was used to. Sort of maybe what I would call creative, improvised, new music, something in that vein. And there was a lot of kind of free improvisation, and the approach was really different. And, you know, it didn't always necessarily swing, but it was still jazz. It was still innovative. It was still improvisation. And that was really exciting to me, really opened my mind up. And, you know, I never want to say, oh, I do this type of jazz or this thing, or even necessarily use the word jazz, because it's like we're not monoliths. We're artists and we're interested in lots of things. But it's like the more you're exposed to, I think just the richer your artistic life is. So I was really lucky to have a lot of a wide variety of, you know, influences in terms of my peers and their interests.
Yeah. Well, that seems to be echoed by every other faculty or student that I've talked to. There is that experience of their togetherness and an expectation of sharing.
Yes.
And not the complete reverse of selfishness is sharing.
Yes.
And I remember when I interviewed Danilo Perez, one of the points that he made, he said, I see a lot of extremely talented musicians. The ones that don't show me that they want to share are the ones that I have to have the difficult conversation with and say, I don't know that this program is for you. Because we are about sharing.
So I love that.
I learned a lot from him in that one interview. Well, speaking of faculty, I know that you've had a wonderful interaction with Terry Lynn Carrington. And for those listeners who are not aware of who she is somewhat legendary as a jazz drummer, having toured with Herbie Hancock, for instance, for many years, Grammy Award winning. She is a Berklee professor and a founder of the Jazz and Gender Justice Group program. So if you just want to share any anecdote or any feelings, I mean, within the limit of time with how, say, Terry Lynn has impacted and helped you with your career.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know if there's really proper words for me to describe the influence and impact she's had on not only, like, my career, but also just how I think about music and how I think about art and how I think about my role in this music and in this community. You know, I think it's interesting. There's just, you have to live with so many contradictions when you're, you know, growing up as a woman in this music. Mm-hmm. There's so many contradictions you have to sort of hold in your mind. And I think when I came into college, of course I was very supportive of women coming into this music, but I also was probably a little bit maybe weary of, you know, trying to do women in jazz things or gender justice things, right, because I felt like, well, you know, I want to, you know, I just want to be integrated into sort of the normal scene, right? Like, I don't want to be separated out.
Sure.
And I think Terry Lynn really helped me understand that we're looking for equity, not mm-hmm. necessarily equality, but equity. Mm-hmm. And really the only way to fix this issue is to sort of rewire the whole thing from the root, mm-hmm. rather than say, well, let's take this community as it is and just sort of put women into it. It's more than that. It's more than just representation. It's actually kind of fixing, or not that we'll ever quote unquote fix it, but, you know, but sort of changing what the art form mm-hmm. has to look like and what the right. culture has to look like kind of from right. the root of it. And I think it's sort of embodied in like the central question of JGJ, the mm-hmm. Jazz and Gender Justice, which is what would jazz sound like without patriarchy? And I think she sure. really focuses on, hey, you know, we're not just doing representation because it's just on a face value, it makes us look good if more women play this music. It's because the music's going to be better. And there's actually a different aesthetic that's being brought into the music. And there is something to be, you know, gained from the community and the culture sort of shifting,
right.
And us setting these new standards, which is, of course, the name of the book and the album. Mm-hmm. But anyways,
yeah,
that's just a huge piece of...
Sure. Well, I'm also thinking in terms of Danilo Perez's program, the Global Institute of Jazz, in that he took a similar concept and said there's unrepresented individuals
yes.
who will never find this program, and they are astounding musicians. And yes. because of their socioeconomic and their remote locations around the world, I'm going to reach out and create an association.
Yes.
And did that, and that's amazing, both of them. Terry Lynn Carrington and Danilo Perez offer a bigger view.
Absolutely.
Well, I think we're going to, at this point, segue into your songs, the two compositions that you've shared with us. And one is Survivor's Guilt, and the other is 2020. Did you want to talk briefly about both of them to introduce them, and then we can just listen and then chat a little bit about what we've listened to?
Sure. So Survivor's Guilt was the opening number of my senior thesis, which was a song cycle that I wrote about chronic illness, invisible disability. I'm a type 1 diabetic,
okay.
and that was something I never thought was relevant to my artistry. And I had an incredible thesis advisor at Harvard, Vijay Iyer, who I've worked really closely with and on this project, and he's been one of the most important mentors, along okay. with Terry Lynn mm-hmm. And others. But anyways, he sort of helped me understand that, hey, this has actually been a very important piece of my artistry, and mm-hmm. this is who I am.
Right.
And this project was really a sort of a healing journey for me in trying to sort of make sense of this disease that I've lived with for so long
right.
through music, and allow myself, give myself the space to actually express it mm-hmm. rather than hide it or pretend like I'm overcoming it, like actually
right.
expressing it.
Okay.
So this tune came out of that work, and that piece was called American Tonic, that thesis. And then the other tune, 2020, is a tune that I wrote in 2020 during mm-hmm. the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is just, I think, a perfect manifestation of like how, where I wished I was, because the piece is sort of full of energy and,
right.
and, that's like kind of the opposite of what I had. I was alone at a piano when yeah. I wrote this, but mm-hmm. I was trying to think of like, what would be the most fun tune I could write for when I get together with people that's just bursting with energy. And so this was the first time I got to play with a band,
mm-hmm.
Was this recording.
Right.
And so I think there's just kind of an energy there. And this tune was also in the New Standards book
okay.
that was released by Terry Lynn.
Yes.
Of 101 Least. Yeah. So this is in that book.
Yeah. Well, great introduction. So we will start with Survivor's Guilt, and we're going to approach the song from a point in which you're going to be soloing on the saxophone.
Awesome.
Wow. For me, a lot of expression and ascending emotion. And now that I understand the background and the meaning of Survivor's Guilt, what I'd written down actually for me as I listened to this the other night was kind of a reaching beyond, a stretching out, trying to express some very intense feelings that come out of the, in a sense, some of the later part of the solo where the saxophone is literally sort of screeching and crying out a bit.
Yes.
So that was my reaction, not knowing what it truly was based on.
I really appreciate that reaction. I think that's exactly what I was sort of going for with this. And at the beginning, it was sort of subtle, but there were some vocalists that were chanting, "It was not death."
Okay.
And that sort of refers to the intro of the piece, which I didn't include, but it was an Emily, I didn't include in this recording that we just played, but it was a setting of the Emily Dickinson poem about this, and "It Was Not Death" is taken from that. And basically, this song is sort of trying to get at this idea of a lethal illness turning into a chronic illness. Like, the discovery of insulin made this disease a death sentence into a life sentence. And so sort of that mixture of, like, you're very grateful for this, but also, as a result, nobody really sees it as a legitimate disability because it's maybe not something that results in death. You can still live with it. And so there's sort of this guilt that you live with of, like, well, you know, how bad can I feel for myself? How right? Like, I have the gift of being able to live through this. And so this is sort of getting at some of those contradictions.
Okay. Very expressive. And thank you for sharing something personal. Well, we'll move on to 2020 then. And again, as you've prefaced, this was actually related to what I got in response from a lot of musicians who felt horribly isolated, as did the rest of the world, but that in particular, their performance-based and their income and their passion depends on them being able to perform. And of course, that's all closed out during that COVID period.
Right.
So we'll listen to 2020 and have some thoughts.
Thank you.
really intensive soaring solo, very different from our previous composition, but that's what makes music so interesting is some of the contrast. But I certainly feel the singing and kind of rejoicing, almost like it's spring and the birds are singing again, and we can be happy about life. So that clearly comes out in there. And I also should say, too, there's so much talent out there. When I listen to the rest of this, two of these releases, the drumming and the piano and the guitar work, particularly the guitar work on Survivor's Guilt, almost sounded like John McLaughlin trying to ascend in a jazz rock fashion. But so you're surrounded by wonderful musicians. Sorry to take a little dog leg there. But so
no, absolutely. And if I could just cut in and say the guitar work on Survivor's Guilt is a dear friend of mine, Emmanuel Michael, and Emmanuel is one to watch.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Then I'm going to make a note of that. Emmanuel Michael. Thank you for sharing. I will make a note of that. Okay. So again, a celebration really is part of the experience of listening to your solo.
I think that it was almost like it was just so automatically a celebration. Like I couldn't help it because I was just so happy. Like I was like, I remember that session, and it was like the first session I had had since everything had gone down. And I was just like, I was so happy. I remember I got home from that and I was like, oh my gosh, like I just, my spirits were lifted. And it really does, it reminded me that like, this is social music, you know, this is music that needs to be shared and done in community and collaboration. Like that's the gig. Like it's practicing alone is not, you know, I mean, people found amazing ways to do things from home alone and it was wonderful, but it just nothing compares to being in the room with people you care about making music. And so I feel like I played that with a smile on my face, you know.
It comes through that way. Well, thank you for sharing two very divergent compositions. Looking forward, you have graduated just recently, and is there a group of musicians who you will seek out when you move to New York, or this is all going to be a new starting point for you when you move to New York City?
Oh my gosh. Well, I think that the relationships I made in college were invaluable, and I have a feeling those are the folks I will probably be collaborating with for the rest of my life, if I had to guess. So I definitely think it will not be a starting from scratch. I hope to take that project American Tonic that I had played part of Survivor's Guilt, but I'm hoping to take that project and develop it further, maybe turn it into my first album release, or maybe even more into a theatrical kind of production. I do a lot in musical theater, sort of my dream is to be able to bring all of these influences and passions of mine together and to be able to sort of improvise in the theater and maybe diversify the types of music that we're hearing in musical theater. And so I think as I move to New York, my goal is to work on larger composition and music directing projects, and also still collaborate with my friends and play in their bands too, because that's the joy, is like of collaboration. It's like working on each other's music and supporting each other and creating a community that really like cares about each other and cares about the music. So so that's sort of what I'm looking ahead to.
Great. Well, it sounds obviously like a very exciting next step.
Yeah.
And New York is certainly a hotbed of jazz activity. I was just going to ask you a general question about jazz in general, the trending as you were a jazz musician. And the mixing of other genres, of course, is a natural process.
Yes.
How do you feel about where jazz is? A big question, but nonetheless, I thought I would ask it.
Oh, my gosh. I think
personally or from your professional side?
That is such a good question and a really tough question. For some, you know, I've heard some people say, like, jazz is dying or jazz is dead, and I really disagree with that. I'm sure you do, too,
good.
If we're here together.
I hope so, yes.
I actually couldn't be more excited about jazz right now, mainly because I think people are starting to Well, it's interesting because in different periods throughout jazz history, I guess, maybe we've defined jazz in different ways. Like maybe jazz, anything that swung was sort of jazz mm-hmm. at one point, or maybe right. anything that had improvisation in it was jazz or whatever. And I think we've always, like, there's been all these different ideas of what jazz had to be, like mm-hmm. big band or bebop or cool jazz. And, like, there were all these different eras. And I think what's exciting now is, like you said, there's kind of this diversifying of quote-unquote genres or whatever, and people are starting to realize that jazz is sort of just innovative music, you know, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. people in collaboration doing innovative things, blurring the line between improvisation and composition and all the things. And I've found that, like, when I collaborate with other young people, so often what we're doing is we're not putting any labels on it. And that is so,
right.
that's really exciting to me. Yes. And I want to be a part of that. Like, let's not force a label on this. Let's, you know, but let's identify the things that make this music so important. Like, what really is the tradition? Is the tradition, right. does it mean it has to swing, or does it mean this? Or is it really just, is the tradition that it's innovative music, it's social music, they're, you know, we're improvising, we're creating in the moment, like, what are the things that really make this music jazz or whatever term we
right.
want to use?
Right.
And so, in my opinion, I'm really excited about where it's going.
Yeah. I seem to feel that more every year I go to the Newport Jazz Festival, because mm-hmm. I feel that I see performances that are or that are wide in their influence of music, but yet there's still this core.
Yes.
What I always find in jazz music, which is a little bit of a maybe a prejudiced point of view of mine, the musician at those levels, or even in school programs, know their instrument exceptionally well.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they get on stage and you have to play and perform, there can't be any empty holes.
Yeah.
They know their instrument and what their instrument is capable of doing. And that adds yes. kind of to the joy to it, because if they're pushed, they can go there.
Yes, so. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, just to add on to that, that the idea of being a virtuoso is also sort of being diversified right now. Like, maybe
right.
there's not one path of, or there's not one sound. Like, there's not one way to be a saxophone virtuoso, but there's so many different ways to be virtuosic. And they all just sort of relate to what you're saying, kind of that relationship with your instrument. And so, but it doesn't necessarily have to be, you're trained in this one way, or you're, you know, so anyways, I'll stop talking now.
That.
But
no, that was my mistake, having it on, but. So this conversation could continue, but it's
yes.
been wonderful to hear from you and from your background and from your experience at Berklee. I always learn more about the program and more about why it's special. And so thank you so much for being here, Veronica.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And best of good fortune with what lies ahead.
Thank you so much.